Greetings and salutations and welcome back to Colin's Last Stand right here on YouTube. My name is Colin Moriarty. I thank you for being here with me today, and I thank you for your time. First of all, I'm sorry if this video looks a little bit like an ISIS recruiting video. Erin, my girlfriend, and I are in flux right now. We're looking to move down to Santa Monica. We just spent the weekend there. We think we found a great apartment. And that apartment will have an extra bedroom, and that bedroom will allow me to have a studio space in which I can have a standing kind of set that will give us better fidelity in terms of video and audio quality, and also something that looks a little bit more like it's of the same series, which I know Colin's Last Stand so far has been a little bit scattered in that respect. So I do appreciate your patience. Keep the feedback coming, of course, and let me know what you think. I'm reading it. So I talked to my father today on the phone. My dad, a devout Catholic, was wishing him a happy Easter, etc., and so on, and we were talking back and forth, and I'm very much my father's son in regards to my historical and political preferences and my love of those things. And so he asked me, hey, Colin, what do you think about what's going on in North Korea? And we had a really enlightening conversation about it. But the thing is that we didn't come to a conclusion. Instead, we dealt a lot with what brought us to this point with North Korea in 2017. And so I want to do a little bit of a video here for you today, not only examining, I think, how we've gotten to this point since 1945 leading up to 2017, but also maybe what we can expect to happen in the next few months or a few years with North Korea, because I think things are finally coming to a real head with them over there in the Hermit Kingdom. So I think a good place to start with this is, again, how we got to this point. And although I'm known to a lot of you guys as being very American-centric in terms of my political and historical knowledge, and that's true, I know a lot about American history and a lot about American politics compared to what I know about a lot of the rest of the world, there are a few things that have happened in the world at different times that I know quite a bit about too, like Nazi Germany, which I'm sure we're going to do some videos on here as well. And North Korea is another one of those things. I am absolutely fascinated by North Korea. I read a lot about it. I watch a lot of videos and I study up on it quite often because it's just unlike anywhere else in the world. And so I thought I'd tell you a little bit of a story about how we got to this point, which I think is fun. And then we'll talk about where we are now and what we can expect to happen. So the story of North Korea as we know it now begins in 1945. 1945, of course, is one of the seminal years in world history because that's when World War II ends. The war in Europe ends, Nazi Germany falls, and of course the war in the Pacific ends as well when Japan, the Empire of Japan, falls. And similar to what happened in Europe, in Western Europe with Germany, in which Germany was partitioned between the Allies, the Americans, the French, the English in the West, and in the East, the Soviets and their satellites kind of took over a sphere of influence over there. A very similar thing happened on the Korean Peninsula, but instead of East-West, it was North-South. Remember that the Soviets promised to invade Japan along with the Americans at Yalta, but didn't end up having to because we used nuclear bombs on Japan and beat them in submission before the Soviets really got involved. But the Soviets were still in that area. And remember, of course, that the Soviet Union extends all the way to the Pacific Ocean, so there was a partition there on the Korean Peninsula as well. North Korea, South Korea. North Korea, above the 38th parallel, goes to the Soviets and their sphere of influence. South Korea, below the 38th parallel, goes to the Americans and their more capitalist sphere of influence, as opposed to the Soviets' communist sphere of influence. Even though there was a lot of strife in Europe in the post-war era, nothing ever came to a head. NATO was formed, the Warsaw Pact, which was basically the Soviets' version of NATO, was formed, and that kept a sort of uneasy peace. But there wasn't so much peace on the Korean Peninsula. It only took 5 years for war to break out after World War II. And that, of course, is known as the Korean War, which raged from 1950 to 1953. And was basically a proxy war between the South Koreans and North Koreans, of course, literally, but also the Soviets and the Chinese, and then the Americans and their allies as well. And this is an important point, by the way, in terms of how we got to this point with North Korea. North Korea, being a communist, closed-off nation, practices what any totalitarian nation would, which is propaganda. They have incredible propaganda that brainwashes their people. And the foundation of that particular brand of propaganda is that the South Koreans and the Americans, primarily the Americans, invade North Korea across the 38th parallel in 1950, and the North Koreans fight back, and then the demilitarized zone that forms in 1953 as a result of that conflict. That's not true, of course, and in reality, in everyone else's reality, the North Koreans cross the 38th parallel, invade South Korea, the Americans rebuff them and push them back, and so an armistice is signed in 1953 that basically puts in stasis the state of war that exists between the two brand new countries. And that's an important note as well. The Korean Peninsula is still at an official state of war to this day, many, many decades later, because an armistice doesn't end the war, it simply freezes it in place. So the Korean Peninsula is in a state of war. North and South Korea have been at war with each other since 1950. It's also important to note, as I've noted in previous videos, that there was a war of containment going on in many places. This is, of course, where West and East Germany come into play. But the war of containment is basically saying, should the United States stop the spread of communism, or should it allow communism to kind of spread unabated? And, of course, this really comes to a head in the even worse proxy war that begins in the 60s, although it foments in the 50s, and even in the 40s, really, in Vietnam. But the Korean War is a part of that equation as well. It's a piece of that puzzle. But unlike Vietnam, which had extreme ramifications at the time, but has really died down since the 70s, the Korean situation has only gotten worse and more extreme as time has gone on. And there's a reason for that, because the North Koreans are absolutely fucking crazy. So I'm not talking again about the North Korean population, which is innocent. A lot of them are innocent bystanders to this crazy dictatorship that they live under, this crazy Juche philosophy. And you can go read about that. That's J-U-C-H-E, the form of communism that they practice over there in North Korea. A lot of them don't know any better, and a lot of them truly are brainwashed. And we should pity them and wish that we could help them. But when I say the North Koreans are crazy, I mean the Kim family. Because what's going on in North Korea is very unique for a communist nation. Although maybe not as unique as Cuba kind of did or does a similar thing. But the Kim family is the ruling family, the dynasty, that rules over North Korea. And that's very dissimilar to what was going on, say, in the Soviet Union. Remember, when the Soviets, the Bolsheviks, killed the Romanovs and took over Russia following World War I, well, the Bolsheviks were ruled by, you know, Trotsky was in there, and then Lenin really was the leader that kind of won that internal struggle. Then Stalin took over and so on and so forth. None of those people were related to each other. But in North Korea, the ruling family, they're intimately related to each other. The founding father, as it were, of North Korea is a man named Kim Il-sung. And Kim Il-sung is looked at as a heavenly, godlike, supernatural figure in North Korea to this day. And he ruled North Korea until 1994 when his son, Kim Jong-il, took over, who similarly is looked at in a godlike, you know, father-son relationship with his dad. His dad is still really the head honcho in that respect, but he is also looked at as a supernatural godlike figure. And indeed, if you look at a picture of the inside of any North Korean dwelling, for instance, you'll always see two portraits of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il right next to each other. And the secret police will actually go around in North Korea every so often, make sure that those pictures are in place, that they're straightened, that they're dusted and cleaned. That's a real thing. Of course, you can see statues and portraits all over their capital city, their showcase capital city of Pyongyang, of those two men. But unlike Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il didn't last very long. He ruled for about 17 years. And in 2011, he died. And after an interesting struggle that we don't know a great deal about outside, because again, they're so homogenous and so closed off that it's hard even for South Korean intelligence to penetrate North Korea, Kim Jong-il's son, Kim Jong-un, took over. And Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il are bad men. They're not necessarily reasonable men. But they're more reasonable and more logical, it seems, and more experienced in the ways of the world and in the ways of diplomacy and in the ways of geopolitics than their son is, or at least Kim Jong-il's son, Kim Il-sung's grandson is, and that's Kim Jong-un. And that's an important point that we're going to get to in terms of where we stand now, because that is a relevant factor into why the situation has suddenly become so dangerous. But to understand what's going on with North Korea now, you need to understand also what was going on with them then. And what's a really interesting point that's lost on a lot of people is that following the armistice in 1953, North Korea's economy and society was progressing at a much higher rate and with much more success than the South Koreans under capitalist tutelage. So until like the late 70s, North Korea was doing better economically. They were doing better societally. They were in that Soviet and then extreme, you know, growing Chinese sphere of influence that allowed them to have trading partners with like-minded societies that would give them fuel, that would give them food, that would give them all of the materials that they need to succeed. And South Korea was struggling a little bit more. But there was an inflection point. And suddenly South Korea started doing better than North Korea. And of course, today we know about all these great South Korean companies that we deal with, like Samsung and LG. Well, they really began at this inflection point. North Korea started to fail at the time that South Korea started to come up. And so there was this great animosity and tension that was building between the two countries on top of the tension that had already existed because of their two different types of political leanings, on top of what was going on because they were under different proxies with the Americans and the Soviets and the Chinese, on top of all of this, the basic fact that they were fighting a civil war, that families were split up, that people weren't able to see each other. In North Korea, even then, and especially now, they are not allowed to leave the country. They are not allowed to travel freely unless they work for the government. And so they don't really know what's going on in the outside world. They haven't known what's been going on in the outside world for a long time, as evidenced by what I told you earlier, that in North Korea, it is conventional wisdom that the South Koreans and the Americans started the Korean War. Again, not true. And so during this time of fomenting change, during this time of unpredictability that began to grow in North Korea as South Korea really began to settle into its own, the North Koreans began to act out. And you can read a lot about this. Assassinations, hijacking of airliners. There's even a story of an American soldier pruning a tree in the demilitarized zone that separates North and South Korea and being murdered with a hatchet by a North Korean soldier. But still, even though there were some outbreaks of limited hostilities, nothing came to a head under either Kim Il-sung or Kim Jong-il. But something terrible happened, specifically from the North Korean perspective, that changed their entire outlook and changed really their entire trajectory even further and made it even worse than it already was. And that's when the Soviet Union fell. Because when the Soviet Union collapsed and turned into the Russian Federation under Boris Yeltsin eventually, well, the North Koreans lost their only major trading partner and they lost their protector. They lost their communist protector. They were not a puppet state like what was going on in Eastern Europe, for instance, but they were certainly protected by a like-minded society, a like-minded government that wanted to prop them up, not because they really gave a shit about North Korea, but because North Korea was the thorn in the side of Japan, was a thorn in the side of South Korea, was certainly a thorn in the side of the United States. And by the way, Japan plays an important role in this as well. And there's animosity between North Korea and really Koreans generally, although not so much in South Korea anymore, and Japan, because Japan really did mistreat and do terrible shit to Koreans in the years leading up to and during World War II. So that's a relevant factor as well that creates a lot of tension in that area of the world. So the Soviet Union falls, and suddenly things don't look so good for North Korea anymore. Suddenly they have much less food, they have much less fuel, they don't have a military protector anymore, and the tables really seem to be turning against them. And this really comes to a head in the mid-90s, where over a few years there are major famines in North Korea that kill, that wipe out hundreds of thousands of people. And it just so happens that, by happenstance really, that the most fertile farmland on the Korean Peninsula is pretty much all in South Korea. South Korea is able to grow its own food, and to grow a lot of food, at least enough rice, etc., to support themselves. But the North Koreans aren't so lucky. It's rocky, mountainous terrain in the north, and they're not able to grow enough food to feed themselves. So this really comes to a head when Soviets aren't there anymore to trade, you know, food with them and to give them raw materials and to give them fuel. The entire society seems like under Kim Jong-il, it's falling apart. And tension continues to grow throughout the 90s and into the 2000s when the North Koreans start becoming more bold with missile tests and start becoming more bold with other weapons tests. And this comes to a head when they, and I think in 2009, detonate their first nuclear bomb. And suddenly they're a nuclear power. Now you have to step back and realize how big of a deal that is. There aren't that many nuclear powers in the world. There hasn't been that many nuclear powers in the world, and there aren't to this day many nuclear powers in the world. In fact, you can name them all pretty easily. You got the United States, you have France, the United Kingdom, you have China, you have Russia, you have Pakistan, you have India, and you think that you probably have Israel, but they don't acknowledge that they have their own nukes. And there were countries that had nuclear bombs or had nuclear programs at one time that no longer had them, that gave them up peacefully, including South Africa. So North Korea joining this club, not by proxy, not because the Chinese have bombs or because the Soviets had bombs, but because they have their own bombs. That makes things very, very serious indeed. Because now, think back to the history I just told you. They have problems, obviously, with the South Koreans. They have problems with the Americans. They have problems with the Japanese. And they're in great proximity of these countries. Remember, Seoul, South Korea, the capital city of South Korea, is a mere 35 miles from the demilitarized zone and from the North Korean border. And Tokyo is pretty close too. It's about 500 miles away from the North Korean coast, the east coast of North Korea. So they can do a lot of damage, especially because in addition to their nuclear capabilities, which are limited and in some cases laughable, their bombs are not very impressive, but nonetheless, they can do damage with those bombs if they can deliver them, and it remains to be seen if they are able to deliver them. A lot of their missile tests failed. One of their missile tests just failed. But they also have chemical and biological stockpiles, and they aren't afraid to use them. Or at least that's how it seems, because any man with this haircut is probably likely to use biological and chemical weapons. But on a serious note, you might be asking yourself a question that's very logical, which is, how has this been allowed to happen for, what is it, like 6.5 decades? Going on 7 decades now? And that's because the North Koreans, under the Juche philosophy, have not only brainwashed their population effectively, and not only restrained and repressed them effectively, but have a very specific set of rules in place that keep everyone in check, or has kept everyone in check up to this point. For starters, we should talk about Pyongyang, which I mentioned earlier, which is their capital city, their showcase city. If you live in Pyongyang, you are amongst the most respected and safest and most prosperous and richest of all North Korean people. It means you work for the government or for the State Workers' Party. It means you work for the military. You're a child of one of the people that works there. You're a teacher. You're a propaganda artist. Any of those kinds of things. If you live in Pyongyang, you are amongst the elite class. That feeds into a Korean system, a North Korean system known as Sunbun, which is this caste system that they have. And there are really three levels of the caste. There are the people at the top that I just mentioned. There are people in the middle that are most of the population. And there are people at the bottom. And you don't want to be at the bottom in North Korea. And when people see what happens to the people at the bottom in North Korea, well, they want to stay at least in the middle. And so there's a lot of fear. This isn't uncommon in totalitarian dictatorships, of course. But it's taken on an extra special level of fucked up in North Korea. Let me give you an example. Let's say that you live in an apartment block in a small city in North Korea, outside of Pyongyang. And you live in this apartment block. Everything's provided to you by the state under the Juche philosophy. And you say something even inconsequential, but seemingly negative about the Kims, for instance. Well, they'll arrest you. They'll arrest your entire immediate family. Let's say you're a father. They'll arrest your children. They'll arrest your wife. They'll arrest your parents. They'll arrest your aunts and uncles and your cousins and your most immediate and closest friends and associates. And they'll throw them all in prison camps. They might execute you publicly in front of thousands of people in order to scare the shit out of everyone to keep them in line. And those people will go to concentration camps that North Korea doesn't even acknowledge exist, but we know exist for two reasons. We know they exist because there are satellite images of them. And more importantly, we know they exist because people that were in the prisons and guards from those prisons have both defected from North Korea over the years and have given us plenty of information about their existence. You have to understand that propaganda is a very powerful tool in North Korea. It is extremely powerful. You'll remember that the hammer and sickle, the famous hammer and sickle, is the symbol of the Soviet Union. The hammer representing the communist worker, the sickle representing the communist agricultural worker. Those two things put together make a powerful Marxist society. Well, the Koreans take it, or at least the North Koreans take it, in a different direction. They have the hammer and the sickle and the paintbrush. The paintbrush represents the artist and the writer, and they're very important components to the highly literate North Korean society. And they're highly literate because it's through that literacy that they're able to be brainwashed. So the North Koreans teach everyone how to read and write. In fact, North Korea is one of the most literate places in the entire world. Bet you didn't know that. And it's through this propaganda that everyone's kept in line. Remember when I told you earlier that they tell everyone that the Americans invaded North Korea during the Korean War, even though that never happened, and that's a foundational sort of thing? Well, everything's built and predicated off of that. Their propaganda machine is very strong. So when you combine their effective propaganda machine with the high literacy of the country in which everyone can read and absorb this stuff, with the godlike stature of the leadership, at least of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, and you combine that with the fact that Kim Jong-un, the leader now, who's Kim Jong-il's son, killed his own uncle in public to make a point. So absorb all that for a minute and really think about what that all means. A highly literate society that has a cult of personality leadership of gods. They can all read about it. They all see art and statues reinforcing it. They have pictures of these men in their homes and in their factories and everywhere around them. And then you have people being sent openly to camps that are never seen from again. If you step out of line, your entire family is therefore stepping out of line and you'll never see them again. Oh, and Kim Jong-un just, you know, kills his fucking uncle in public to make a point about what's going on. And in a way, that brings us to today. Because this society, this very backwards, what they call the Hermit Kingdom, this society where no one can leave, no one can travel freely, even between towns in that place. The leadership and the elite live in one isolated area. Everyone else lives in destitution everywhere else. They're eating tree bark. They're barely able to survive. Their children are dying. North Korea suffers from so much malnutrition, chronic malnutrition, that it's predicted that 25% of their children are chronically malnourished. 25%. If you take a North Korean child of 8 or 10 years old and put him next to, or hard next to, a South Korean child of 8 or 10 years old, you might notice a difference in height and weight simply because of nutrition. Remember, the North and South Koreans are fighting what are basically in a state of civil war. They're of the same stock. It's not like they're coming from different areas. That's due to a lack of food and a lack of nourishment in the North. These people are repressed and demeaned and kept in check in every way possible. But there's a problem. The North Koreans can no longer control the flow of information into their country. for many decades before the internet revolution, before cell phones, before all of that, they were pretty able and willing to control the flow of information. They were able to do that. The newspapers people read were newspapers printed in North Korea. The magazines were magazines printed in North Korea. The television sets that they watch in North Korea are given to them by the government. And if you, you know, mess with them in any way to get more than the two or three channels they allow you to get, well, you'll go to one of those prison camps that I talked to you about earlier. But the internet, cell phone signals, all of this are very hard to control. Remember what I told you earlier, North Korea and China touch each other. And so through China comes cell signals. Through China comes a lot of smuggled goods. Chinese soldiers and North Korean soldiers are apparently very easily bribed and tricked. And so people are bringing in DVDs and laptops and cell phones and smartphones. And people are slowly learning about what's going on. And the same thing's happening from the South. South Korean cell phone signals are crossing the DMZ. And every once in a while, South Korean people even send over pamphlets that land in North Korea that tell them what's going on, tell them everything they know is a lie. Everything's starting to become a little bit unhinged for the North Korean government. North Korea is counteracting this in ways that seem clever, but I don't think it's going to work forever. For instance, they are a totally controlled economy, except for now they're apparently turning a blind eye towards small markets, bartering markets that are opening up outside of Pyongyang in small towns, cities, and villages all around North Korea so that people are no longer necessarily starving to death. If someone has a surplus of rice, they can trade it for a surplus of fish or meat that someone else has and so on and so forth, or eggs or whatever it happens to be, to keep people just in a little bit better shape than they were beforehand. So maybe they turn a blind eye to those rumors that they've been hearing and seeing from their friends that might have seen a cell phone or might have gone on the internet or might have watched a Western DVD or gotten a newspaper that has come in from the Chinese border. So things are becoming very serious there indeed. But you have to understand that the crazier this situation gets, the more repressive, the more regressive, the more violent, and the more out of the ordinary Kim Jong-un is going to become. Because there's one thing that's clear about this man. He is paranoid. He is extremely paranoid. Not an uncommon trait amongst communist dictators, of course. Look what Stalin did to his own people. So the question that my father and I were asking on the phone this morning was simple. What do we do about this? What do we do, considering the history that I just told you about, considering how we got to this point, considering the inflection point that put the South on top of the North economically and culturally, considering the fact that North Korea is completely closed off to the rest of the world, millions upon millions upon millions of people there have no clue what's going on around the world, that there is the Sanban system that keeps people apart from each other, the threats of labor camps, the threats of execution, whether private or public. What do you do? What do you do in that situation? The fact of the matter is there's only a few ways forward. That's all there is to it. We could go into North Korea. We could take Pyongyang in probably a day or two and knock them out. Their military is backwards. They have a great standing military, one of the greatest numerically standing militaries in the entire world, in fact. But they're using Soviet-era technology, Soviet-era guns, Soviet-era planes. They have barely a navy to speak of. But again, thinking about the history with Japan, thinking about the civil war ongoing with the South Koreans. If the U.S., for instance, goes in, well, Seoul and Tokyo are going to pay the price, not Los Angeles or Seattle. All this hullabaloo about how the North Koreans can strike the west coast of the United States, or even the Aleutian Islands, or even Hawaii, I think is totally overblown. Anyone who thinks the United States doesn't have the world's most state-of-the-art, most sophisticated missile defense system, I think is really kidding themselves. We've never seen it work. We've never had to. We could wait it out, but I don't know that that's the humanitarian thing to do. We've been waiting for decades. There's been lots of predictions over the decades that that North Korea was on the verge of falling, that they weren't going to last much longer. But it's all been for naught. It's just not true. They've lasted. They've lasted through the fall of the Soviet Union, the turnover of two family members, famine, overt executions and labor camp usages and concentration camps. I mean, they've survived everything. It doesn't seem like they're going to fall. But that information, again, that information is being fomented amongst the population in ways we don't understand. They're so homogenous that South Korea can't even really infiltrate the country effectively with their own intelligence services. But we have to imagine that the people there are getting an idea of what's going on in the rest of the world, and they're understanding that they're being lied to. And of course, we have to ask ourselves, what's up with the Chinese and what they're going to do? Because they're complicit in this. The Chinese are complicit in this, just like the Soviets were as well. The Chinese have propped this country up long enough, and stationing 150,000 soldiers on that North Korean border, which apparently they've just done in recent days, isn't a sign, I don't think, that they're going to invade or pincer the country with the United States coming from the south and the Chinese coming from the north. I don't think that's going to happen. They're afraid of a refugee crisis. They don't want to deal with it. The status quo for the Chinese is probably preferable to something else, because then they're going to have to deal with millions of North Korean refugees that they're going to have to house and feed and figure out. And of course, the South Koreans, over time, since the Sunshine Policy was instituted and everything seemed to be just fantastic, they don't seem to really want much to do with the North Koreans either. As people in South Korea die that have familial connections to people in the North or fought in the war or remember the days of yore, when those people go away, well, the South Koreans now, all they see on their ledger is, this is going to cost us a lot of money. These people are really different from us. They've been walled off from us for generations, and they're not our responsibility anymore. So from every point of view, this is very complicated. And that's why I want to throw it back to you guys and see what you think about it. And maybe we can talk about it in the comments, and maybe I can do another video in the coming weeks. And I mean, this situation is moving quickly. I mean, by the time I put this video up, this video is going up in 12 hours from when I'm finishing recording this. Anything can happen. So what do we do? Do we wait it out? Do we go in? Is there a third way? You know, one of the questions my father and I were asking each other, which I think is an interesting one, it's a scary question to ask, but it's an interesting one. The idea of mutually assured destruction, MAD, the nuclear idea that we all have weapons, we all are willing to use them, and it's the doctrine that we don't use them so that no one else uses them on us. And it kept the peace during the Cold War. But what do you do if you go in to North Korea and they use sarin gas on Seoul, or they nuke Seoul? Do you have to respond in kind? It's a difficult question. It's a question I don't even want to think about. But it's a question we have to think about. That makes it even scarier. So sound off in the comments. Let me know what you think. I'll be down there talking to you guys. You can join us on Reddit, Facebook, etc. and so on. I also want to remind you that this is entirely fan-funded. Colin's Last Stand is entirely fan-funded. There are no baked-in ads or advertisements. As we speak right now, I don't even have YouTube monetized at all. The only revenue stream for this show is on Patreon. So I hope you consider going over there if you like the content and want to support independent political and historical content, news, etc. and so on. Throw a dollar at me a month, $5, $10 a month. There's some interesting things going on over there, lots of interesting conversation. And while everyone's welcome and you don't have to pay for the content, I do hold a very special place in my heart for people that fund it. So thank you so much for supporting me in that respect. Speaking of respect, show respect to each other in the comments as well, and keep that conversation going. Let me know what you think about this whole situation, about the history, about the future, about the present. And of course, more than anything, keep on learning. Thank you so much for your time. Have a good day.